What's up, guys? Welcome to the Heads Up Advisor podcast. My name's John Sfracco. On this episode, we're going to be bringing you a live episode at the ranch with Ed Jacobson and Hobson Carroll. We did have a little hiccup. We forgot to hit the record button for 5 minutes. My fault, but I didn't want to lose the episode for you guys because I thought it was that good. We're going to bring you right in. Let's cut right into 5 minutes into this episode. I'll see you guys.
We asked the employee the question, the employees. There were about 20, 25 employees in the room. And I said, how many of you used your automobile insurance today? And nobody raised their hand. I said, how many of you used your homeowner's insurance today? Nobody raised their hand. And I said, well, how many of you would like to use your life insurance today? And all of a sudden, I saw in two or three of the 25 a glimmer of hope. And then I said, how many of you have used your health insurance today? And one person actually said, well, actually, I went to the doctor this morning. What's the lesson there? Health insurance is not looked at as insurance. We pay a premium for our automobile, hoping that we never have a claim. We pay homeowners insurance, hoping that our house will not burn down today. But when it comes to health insurance, it isn't worth a damn unless I paid a dollar in and collected more than a dollar from the system. People do not realize that it's the cost of claims that results in the premium. We have a mutual friend who comes up with a very simple formula. How do you calculate premium? Premium equals crap. C, claims. R, reserves. Why reserves? Because claims don't come in the day you incur them. So you have to, if you have a claim today, you set aside reserves for the payment of that claim in the future. A is administration, the cost of somebody processing the claim, the cheapest of all the costs. And then P is pooling. Pooling is necessary only for groups that are not large enough to have extreme credibility. Because if your premium is $1 million a year and the claim pops up and it's a $4 million premature baby, that plan is in a deficit position for a very long time, trying to make up for that significant claim. So the only insurance in an insurance plan, the only true insurance, is the pooling. The rest of it's cost plus.
And pooling's built into, you see it in a fully insured renewals. Is it built in self-funded stop loss?
In a self-funded plan, pooling is basically referred to as stop loss.
Premium.
Typically specific stop loss.
It's built in the premium, right?
It's a premium charged that is built into the funding of the plan. We don't use the term premium in a self-funded plan. You pay a premium for any insurance product you purchase, which is stop loss. But when you're self-funding your employee's benefit plan, you are simply funding the cost of your claims, the reserves, the administration, and you pay a premium for the pooling. The only premium involved in a self-funded plan is the pooling premium.
I'm going to go to Hobson. Hobson, what do you think of that? Did he explain that right? Because we're going to bring the actuary in on that one.
I wanted to go back to your original question, which I don't think even got addressed, but that's beside the point, which was what? In 1964, you know, did we even have health care, which has an interesting...
I'm going to run for politics. You don't answer questions.
I will suggest the following. In insurance theory, you know, we have an old saying that goes like this. It says, if you want to collect on a life insurance policy, you have to die. Aside fringes where people fake their deaths and all, we're talking about legitimate situation, okay? You want to collect on a life insurance policy, you got to die. You want to collect on a disability policy, you got to be disabled. You want to collect on a health insurance policy, you just have to have a policy. That's what Ed was alluding to with the idea. It all has to do with perception of people as to what insurance really is. All those people in the room, you had used their homeowner's insurance and had used their auto insurance that
day. Right.
They hadn't gotten benefits from it, but they were protected. Insurance is an intangible item. People don't relate well to intangible items. If they can't drive it, if they can't eat it, if they can't drink it, if they can't wear it, if they can't have sex with it, they don't understand it. Okay? It's an intangible. Protection is something that, and insurance and healthcare.
I thought healthcare, protection applies during sex ed.
Okay.
More and more today,
Healthcare insurance.
In 64, it didn't, by the way.
Healthcare insurance has gotten to the point where it's confused with what Ed talked about, the benefits. The whole idea is if you go to the doctor for a routine office visit for something, you've got a cold, you feel run down, your kid's got, you know, you think they have strep throat or something like that. They want that covered as insurance, but in reality, that's just part of everyday life that you have to deal with.
But
that's a benefit. Our system in the United States has gotten to the point where it is expected of the insurance plan, the health insurance plan, to cover more than true insurance, which is the high cost, rare event things, okay, that might occur. You come down with cancer next year. You have a heart attack next year. You become pregnant next year. Okay. And that creates a large expense, you know, sitting out there that you're going to have. That's what insurance is for. It's not really for the small stuff, but we have to just accept the fact that our system has come to.
But at what point? So that's what I was trying to make a point is like, at what point did consumers start to think, well, shit, this is part of what I pay in premium. And it's played great for the insurance companies.
Well, I don't know that the people, okay, we got to go back to that 64 point, okay, and say, okay, what was medical care and health care in 1964? Okay, we had two drugs, penicillin and aspirin, all right? We had basic doctor visits where you didn't go to the doctor unless, you know, you were bleeding or whatever, you know. I mean, I remember hitting my head and going to the doctor for stitches all the time, you know. That was the only time that we went, and then my mother would have to go, you know, do some deal with, hey, can I bring you a casserole or whatever in order to help pay for it, okay? And doctors were used to dealing with people directly to take care of what it cost. You know, the rare occasions where you went to the hospital, okay. We had insurance. You got to remember that in World War II, okay, we allowed for the tax protection of benefits for health insurance. That's when it all basically started. They said, you can't have to the workers who were still here who weren't in the Army and the Navy and the Marines, okay, you can't have a salary increase, but we won't tax benefits if they give you benefits. That got, you know, kind of like set in concrete in like the 54 Tax Act, I forget, or something like that, where they said that was the case. All those countries we were fighting to help save over in Europe, okay, they were all destroyed. They got to start from scratch after the end of World War II. So they decided they would have national healthcare systems. That's where they all came from. They didn't really, well, they sort of existed in Germany, but then they don't count because they were on the other side. Anyway, they all started from scratch and said, we're going to create we're creating our whole system now. We're going to just build that into what we're building. They could start from scratch. They didn't have an existing system that they had to work with. They didn't have anything. Okay. We, on the other hand, had started this process of, okay, letting the employers provide benefits. And that's how our society.
In lieu of compensation.
In lieu of compensation, our society basically said, okay, that's how we're going to provide healthcare insurance benefits. Okay.
And let me stop you for a second. So it's when it happened, it was it an employer tactic to recruit talent and say, hey, we'll pay for it, come work for us?
Well, eventually, no, at that time, it was just...
Why would employers say, hey, I'm going to pay for your health insurance?
Well, because they couldn't give raises, and there was a shortage of, you know,
so
people...
So was it cheaper, you said you couldn't give raises,
well,
was
again,
it cheaper to give health?
In 1943 and 1944, it didn't cost, you know, it didn't cost them much. So we didn't have medical technology, we didn't have, you know... The drugs we didn't have, you know, it's like it was pretty basic stuff. And then you had your high cost stuff when you had to go to the hospital. There was a clear division between what were the basic benefits that you should just take care of and then the stuff that was true insurance. So in the 50s, though, right, there was a lot of competition. We were booming. The vets came back. They went to school. They got degrees. There was competition for lives. The 50s boom. We did great in the 50s. So by the 60s and in there, okay, this was sort of the accepted way that we were going to provide health insurance benefits. You know, there were no government program, whether it was the veterans benefits, I assume, were existing about that time. But I mean, there was nothing else. And then somebody came along and said, look, in the early 60s, they said, we got two main sources of poverty in this country. We got old people and we got kids from poor families. And so, and one of the main problems they have is they can't get any health care. They can't afford health care. basic doctor visits and immunizations, which were starting to be a thing. Okay, there were some immunization drugs. Okay, fine. They started to roll about that time, right? And so what happens? They pass Medicare and Medicaid, okay, to deal with those two populations, the elderly and mostly kids, but those from poor families. Okay, that's what that they were trying to address, the kids mostly. Okay, well, all of a sudden, doctors started seeing patients who actually had somebody going to pay for their visit. Okay, that hadn't happened before. They might have helped those poor kids. They might have helped that elderly person, but you know, it was like, you know, okay, here, you want to give me a chicken for that? Okay, fine, I'll take it. Okay, that happened a lot, right? I mean, the doctors took lots of stuff in exchange for, you know, payment for services. Suddenly, there was a cash mill going on. Okay, not only that, the insurance benefits, the insurance industry were competing with each other now because healthcare insurance was just starting to be a bigger dollar volume business.
Who were the players then at that time?
Well, oh, God.
All the Blue Cross organizations, and they were all separate then, so maybe 60 or 70 of them, because some states had more than one. Blue Cross and Blue Shield were often separate, so that maybe there were 150, I don't know. And Prudential and New York Life and all the big insurance
companies. Connecticut General,
Insurance companies,
Aetna.
Everybody's in
health.
Had
health insurance plans because their agents had to have a plan to sell, okay? And they were all, you know, copying each other. And so you had the scheduled benefits like Ed described, and you had major medical that was jumped on top of it. But it was like, you know, $10,000 annual maximum benefits. There were some individual policies that had very interesting characteristics, like two-year accumulation periods, three-year benefit periods, really strange-looking thing, per-cause deductibles as opposed to the annual deductible, et cetera. But the key here was that doctors and providers started seeing money coming in for populations that they previously couldn't count on for much money. Also, about that time, there was starting to be a transformation from the old, what was called military industrial complex to what I've called the medical industrial complex. Okay, slowly but surely, because businesses and researchers and the stuff that was going on in academia, they started addressing medical care. Why? Because that was the one frontier that we hadn't been able to deal with. Okay, how do we get people to live longer? We got to figure out how to take care of these diseases and these sicknesses, and we got to come up with ways.
Is what year now?
In the 60s. That just,
Ed, you were
so,
already,
so we
you
started
already,
to have more
Ed,
drugs.
You were already 30 at this time?
No. I was 20. I was 20 in my early 20s. I was 20 when I started in the industry. But we didn't have premature baby large claims. In fact, when I first started with MassMutual, we made a major, major improvement in our major medical plan. We went from a $10,000 lifetime maximum benefit to $50,000.
And why? Because cost of care went up?
Cost of care went up. Nobody had a $10,000.
The $50,000 wasn't viewed as being going to cost that much more because nobody had claims like
that's
that.
That's right.
So why was it created then? Was it
brokers?
Again, I'm trying to stop.
No, they demanded a differential in the marketplace. They said, give me something
give
more.
Give me better coverage so I can sell some. But was it from the premise of, hey, we can charge more money because we can charge the insurance companies? And was it the provider system, hospitals, to say we could charge more and get paid through insurance? Is that
the
when
carriers
it started
wanted to differentiate themselves?
Okay. It's strictly carrier at that time. Yeah, there wasn't much claims.
Whether a Blue Cross or the when we say carrier, we're talking everybody who was providing a level of, quote, insurance, unquote, for healthcare episodes. Blues, all the major insurance companies, regional. When I moved to Kansas City in 1966, Businessmen's Assurance was a local Kansas City-based insurance company. Very, very aggressive carrier in my part of the country, in central Kansas, Missouri. There was a lot of competition. Competition breeds innovation. Competition breeds improvements.
Competition breeds excellence.
And, well, not necessarily.
Not in
it
the
just
insurance
breeds.
Industry.
Everybody copies the bad idea. Is that excellence?
Yeah. You know, I mean, even, you know, we had to differentiate ourselves at MassMutual by saying, you ready for this? We were the only major medical carrier that covered gingivectomies and apiscectomies.
Don't even know what that is.
gum diseases. Under our major medical, not under a, there was no dental benefits back then. Very few employers, except the very large ones, had dental benefits. So we improved our product by saying, well, you know, you could spend $1,000 with if you had gingivitis. So we're going to cover it.
And if it's medically related, because if you don't take care of it, you're going to get sick in other ways.
That's right. That's right. Sort of like an impacted tooth.
Well, if I'm hearing correctly, we
lead to a heart attack.
I can tell you about my wisdom. I got my wisdom teeth out in the hospital because when my freshman year of college, when I came home for Christmas break, first day I'm in the hospital to get my wisdom teeth taken out. Why? Because that was the only way the insurance was going to pay for it. It wouldn't pay for it if you did it in the dentist's office, but it paid for it if it was in the hospital. So they got a thing that says, yep, my mouth is small, it's difficult, got to do it in the hospital. That's how I got my dental claims.
So as the insurance companies improved the depth and width of their country, of their products, the marketplace adapted to it. The providers adapted to it. My first health plan, we had an $18 a day room and board benefit.
So it paid up to $18.
Up to $18 a day. The surgery schedule had a maximum benefit of $300. California relative value. And it was right in your booklet. You could look up hernias. You could look up deliveries of children. You could look up...
Not abortions.
No, they didn't know. Not abortions back then. But the point was, and then you had, ready for this? If a doctor visited you while you were in the hospital, Mass Mutual paid $5 a day for each hospital visit.
That's your primary doc visit.
Your primary doc. Yeah, there were no...
They'd come and check on you.
Yeah, they'd come and check on you, say how you doing, read your chart, and $5. So they were running around reading charts all day, or at least all morning while they were in the hospital. So yes, coverage dictated because people were seeking ways to get benefits and get coverage without coming out of pocket.
What I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, is insurance companies...
Contributed to the problem.
Yeah, they wanted to be more competitive in the market to get people to buy their products, so they added more and more incentives. And as they added more better so-called coverage and incentive benefits, the hospitals, the doctors found ways around to bill them.
It's what I call the field of dreams syndrome.
Yeah, build it,
they
will
come. If you build it, they will come. And nowhere have we seen it more in evidence than when the ACA was passed and they made us take off any dollar limits on annual or unlimited maximums. That's why we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years the huge increase in $3 million claims, $6 million claims, $10 million claims, $20 million. Okay, because there's no end in sight anymore, okay? Now, that's human nature, I suppose, to some extent. But before that, I can remember in the late 90s, or early part of the century, of this century, you got to be careful.
Where,
you know, we had claims at TPAC, we had claims that would come in, and we had some big premies.
Yep.
And they just would accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. And then suddenly, when the maximum benefit was reached, guess what? The doctors throw up their hands and say, you know, we've done everything we possibly. It's sad, but it was true. We've done everything we possibly can, and the kid would die. They would pull the plug, and the kid would die.
Because they knew they weren't going to get paid.
They weren't going to get paid anymore. Not all of them, but, you know, you could see it. You knew it was happening. And that's, again, that's human nature. So all of this stuff is starting to whirl underneath, okay? It's like one of those things that you don't see. It's underneath the surface, and then it's, but stuff's going on, and you feel a little rumble, and then all of a sudden it booms through, and once it's through, you can't put it back.
At the risk of appearing to be an ogre and a very bad person, our technology also has not only increased the cost of providing care, but I believe it has resulted in a less adaptable human species. If you believe in survival of the fittest, okay? When you take an infant that when I started in the industry, they would have put in the nursery and put it on oxygen, and if it lived, it lived. Now we can take a 1 pound, 1.5 pound or less premature child, bring them with many, many dollars spent to childhood, adulthood, and the question becomes, are we improving our lot, or are we then having those children reproduce and create additional issues. That's a terrible thing to say.
But I'm an ogre too.
It's a fact.
Meaning, should we continue their life or they shouldn't be living? Is that what you're getting at?
I don't know that I want to be that much of an ogre.
Listen, this is the real podcast. So
when I was little, I mean, I'm one of those kids, because when I was little, I had horribly bad eyes. Okay. They're not the greatest now because I had cataract surgery. But when I got cataract surgery, I could suddenly see. Okay. Because the lens they put in my eye made me see. But when all my youth, I had glasses, you know, with the Coke bottle bottoms, they were that thick. In the old days, you know, the bear would have caught me, because I wouldn't have seen the bear coming. It would have eaten me. I'd be dead. Okay. Now that's a simple example, but you expand that idea to the technology of how, you know, how we've changed the human species. Now, is that a great thing? Is this a good thing? So
socially, it's a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful thing. But that actually gets to a good question about today, which is, how much can we spend on healthcare? Let's assume we had the waste out of the system. We would still be having a lot of money to spend on healthcare. Is there a number that our society would accept and say, you know what? We're not spending more than that. Portland did that a few years ago with their Medicaid expansion. If you're going to cost us more than that, you don't get coverage. Okay. The NICE, that's the abbreviation for it over in England, the committee that basically determines what things are going to be covered over there, they do a calculation based on how much it's going to cost versus the life year expectancy and the amount that that's worth. And if you don't make the cut, they don't provide that service.
And that was
brought
up with Obamacare with the death panels, remember?
Well, yeah, but we never really saw that, but they said it was going to come from it. But
yes,
people are, I mean, and especially, and if you consider our social cultural trajectory to move to something like is in France or Germany or the Netherlands or England or Canada even, okay, it becomes very, very difficult because of all of the emotional and political and religious influences on our system have a bearing on how much we spend on healthcare in this country.
Define right.
Well, I'm just making an observation, okay, of the situation.
Well, it depends on your society.
If you're the one that's sick, then yes, we should do it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I'm afraid to say that because I'll be considered to be an ogre. But the point is, we can't spend an endless amount.
I'm not going to package this against you. I'm just asking you as two people.
Yes, you are. I know you. I saw you whispering over there.
Like, Bob and Robin in the back here chiming in.
This is off the record.
We're going to get them a mic.
Is it the right thing to do, though?
Okay. What specifically?
To have a government health system. Is the right.
It is a solution.
It's a definite good way to ration.
It's
a much better way to ration without directly. See, when you say that child or that adult, you know, who's 78 years old, all right, is going to require $4 million worth of health care to live possibly another 2 weeks to 2 years. What's right? I don't know the answer to that, and I'm approaching that age.
Yeah, and who makes a determination? My good buddy Tom Emmerich would say, is a pharmacist of mine, buddy, would say, it's like, you look at a drug like Harvoni, it's $100,000. You got somebody that's 70-something years old, no sign in sight of symptoms, or the however they count the Harvoni, I forget. But the way these insurance companies write up their plan docs and stuff and PBM contracts, they say, absolutely, if you have any trace whatsoever, $100,000 drug. Now, we know why they want to fill it, but it lays dormant in X number of people, a high percentage of people. And if they do have a symptom, we can cure it. But the drug companies say we should give everybody the $100,000 med. And I think if we cured everybody with Harvoni, it would be $3 trillion, if I'm not mistaken in numbers. I could be wrong. So where does that determinant factor go? When you have the insurance companies setting those guidelines around rebates and things, how they get paid, that's where the problem comes.
Well, the insurance companies, in my opinion, are not setting those guidelines.
No, there's two factors.
The drug companies we've got this drug. We've spent time and effort and a lot of federal money researching this drug. So the population has, in many cases, paid for the research, which isn't brought to the forefront very frequently. But anyway,
the basic question is, who says it's a $100,000 drug? And that's the question as to why we have a problem today.
So
that
it's,
same drug in India.
Well, what? Yeah. Well, what happened?
$6,000 to $8,000.
Egypt is $5,000.
Yeah.
Because Egypt can't afford it. Well, here's one of the reasons we pay what we pay in this country. We pay for the research for the entire world in pharmaceuticals, or most of it, in a lot of other areas, right? We end up paying $100,000 because that's the price that they want over here. They come up with it because they look at what the market can bear. They look at what alternative costs are. They look at a number of things like that. My perspective on it is, well, if Egypt can't afford $100,000, if $100,000 is the true cost, if it's the true cost, then that's what Egypt should have to pay as well. And we say, well, Egypt can't afford that. Well, then let's give Egypt the money separately through some other thing so that we can account for where the money is going. When we let them pay $5,000 for it, there's a whole bunch of money that's gone that we've essentially given to them, but we haven't accounted for it. Okay, because it's in that $100,000 that we're paying. I'm for proper pricing and then accountability so that we know. I'm not saying don't give them the money to cover the cost. If the true cost is $100,000, then maybe we should donate, the world should donate money to Egypt to pay for those patients. Don't let them pay $5,000 because that distorts the price.
Yeah.
We don't know what the price should be. And that's the problem with most of healthcare.
I think they're giving it to them as charity to what they could pay for it and obviously upcharging us because they can get away with it. But the guidelines are going to state in these PBM contracts that it's based on the drug manufacturer rebates and incentive programs that say, listen, eliminate the competition on your contract, okay, and fill this med, make it easier to fill this med and make them jump through hoops to fill the other med that's cheaper. And if you do that, we'll pay you more money. If you eliminate, I mean, one of the drugs is if you just eliminate the competition, okay, and it has better efficacy, but make them take the other one that's, you know, not as good efficacy, harder to take. But if you fill more of it and eliminate the competition, we'll pay you bigger rebates. And that's what happens with a lot of these drugs. And
well, remember, the rebate is an American phenomenon.
Well, rebate, whatever you want to call it.
Primarily, because at $5,000, I doubt in Egypt that there's a rebate on Hervoni. So that system contributes to the excessive cost of drugs. I mean, the fact there shouldn't be rebates. There should be realistic pricing for drugs.
And everybody should have access to that price. That would take care of a lot of the problems in our system, i.e.
But guys, it's
an all-payer system.
We can argue back and forth on it because, you know, it's going to be a long time before it changes. Even Trump right now, he's pulled back on the push of drugs and transparency and all that.
There's way too much money involved.
It's just so much.
Way too much lobbying involved.
I mean, I look at it like this, right? I'm in the brokerage side. I fight it myself of being the greed of, do I go on the other side? I'm on the right side. I'm doing what's right for the clients. And at the end of the day, employees and clients, sometimes they don't even give a shit. They don't appreciate what you do. So why don't I just go on the other side? Because I'm going to give them what they want. Now, you guys aren't necessarily client facing. You were probably at some point. Hobson, you're not on an employer side of facing, so you don't see the entitlement factor, the I want this and I don't give a damn because I pay insurance premiums side, or is they don't want to play ball with you on what the right thing to do is to fix the own problem for them. Because I tell enrollment meetings is, listen, we're all in this together, guys. If somebody in here goes against what our plan is, then everybody gets hurt. And at the end of the day, everybody's about their self-served interest and they don't give a shit at the end of the day. Because, oh, well, right? This is the way it is. Well, so that's a challenge from our side. It's seeing it and hearing it and being in self-funding and watching things not go as smooth as we want is
to my knowledge, we are the only society that allows an employer to provide benefits in lieu of compensation, and we incentivize that employer by reducing, by not having those dollars spent be subject to tax.
Massive extent that we have.
We do it.
I mean, there might be some of that. You got to remember, it's that all these so-called single payer countries. Okay. You look, France is not, I mean, yes, they have a government program, but almost every employer has to offer a supplemental coverage to pay the excess amount that doctors actually charge above what the government will pay. Okay. The Netherlands, same way. Germany, same way. England has a private healthcare system. They have a private health insurance system. Like 11% of the population has consistently purchased private healthcare insurance, which allows them to jump queues. Okay. Actually, the only true single payer country, okay, that is anywhere close in the first world is our neighbors to the north. They have a true single payer system. They don't allow private health insurance for the things that the provincial plans cover. Okay. But over in Europe, they all have, and they're all suffering from trend problems, erosion problems of their systems. They're trying to figure out how to solve the healthcare problem just like we are. But, well, not just like we are, but in a way like we are. We're dealing with the problem. No, they're dealing with the problem, not to the same yep. extent, because they came from a different path. Okay.
They're in a parallel course.
And
so Canada's struggling the same way we are, or not to the.
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Canada rations. Yeah, the wonderful thing about for Canadians is they simply cross the border if they've got any money and they pay for it. And
well,
get
that's the thing is that
now.
My father would tell me, "Hey, listen, in Canada, you better wait in line, because if you're 30 years old and you, or if you're 60 years old and you need knee surgery, well, the 30-year-old's more important to you, and you better get in line for 18 months."
And why is the 30-year-old more important?
Because
the 30-year-old has more productivity, future productivity available for the society. All right. And again, it's sort of like, you know, when there's a serious accident or an injury and you go before a judge or a jury and they assess the economic value that this person has lost as a result of that injury. All right. And that assessment is related to the economy in general. You know, if that person would have lived and they would have gone to college, they would have made $23 million in their lifetime. We've had a brain injury as a result of this accident, so we're going to award, you know, all medical bills and $50 million of punitive damages.
Plus the lawyer fee.
Well, the lawyers get their share of the. But the point is, it still ties back to an economic value of a human being. We're in a capitalistic environment. Even socialistic countries have to generate tax revenue. How do they generate tax revenue? By taxing workers, right? So if a worker is no longer productive, then you've got a reduction in that tax revenue, and that impacts everything, including the largest expenditure most countries have, which is the cost of providing healthcare coverage or healthcare services to their population. I mean, we've gotten ourselves into an interesting situation. If we didn't have anybody earning income, where would the government get the money to pay for anything? So our livelihood, our future is directly dependent on the productivity of the population. And there is no answer. I mean, I've been for 55 years now, I've been trying to figure out a way to come up with a better mousetrap. And I have been unable to do it, and I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but other smarter people have tried, and there is no solution. There are only attempts to control costs. And that's where I think we've, as an insurance industry, we failed by making patients not feel responsibility for anything they spend.
And I always say, did we not give them what they wanted? Is this not what the consumer wanted, patient wanted?
Let's talk about the consumer, because a lot of benefits were directly attributable to unionization. And the only way that a union could really impress their members is to provide them with greater and greater benefits. I mean, you know, it's the old story, just like the brokers are faced with. You know, thank you very much for saving me a few bucks last year, but what are you going to do for me today? And everybody's looking for a solution that's better tomorrow than the solution we use today. And, you know, a lot of our benefit structure way back when I started, all right, was directly a result of unionization, union activity in the major Midwestern and Northeastern unions. And it sort of set the tone for the type of benefit designs that came down the pike. Now it's reached its own inertia. I mean, it's sort of like the snowball going downhill. It's getting larger and larger and larger. Originally, the snowball was thrown by the unions.
So the insurance companies create these products to be competitive, to sell more, to get the buyers to want the better benefit that most won't need or use. And now you've got the unions coming in saying, hey, we're going to offer you these better plans. And back then, maybe they weren't as expensive, like you said, to buy up. They weren't that much more money because nobody used it.
Little historical lesson. The first group I sold out of training school, I moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
What year?
1964. September 1st, effective date. I'm sorry, October 1st, effective date, 1974. The single employee rate for a very comprehensive plan for 1964 was under $7 an employee a month. The additional cost for dependents was under $12 because it was about $18, $19 a family per month. A family. I wrote the account. I'll never forget the account. It's a company called Jacobs Cooperage Corporation. They made barrels. It's a cooperage company. They made wooden barrels. Had about 90 employees. A year later, we delivered a 10% rate increase, which means that the rates went up less than a dollar an employee, all right, and less than $2 a family. They left my company and went to New York Life for a lower rate.
But at the time, is it relative, right? Is 70 cents increase relative?
Well, it's relative only to the extent that back then the cost of health insurance was nowhere near the cost it is to the American family budget today.
Okay, relative to the gross income and percentage of your income.
Hey, I was making $100 a week.
Okay. Yeah, so it's
$430 a month. So what's seven bucks?
You can't compete. So it's not even
less than 2%.
Yeah, it's not relative. So at what point, so we give them what they want, the unions get this. At what point, Hobson, through the system in those years, he's talking 1960s, he's a little bit older than you. At what point does it just start to really spiral where you see it go?
Well, the general inflation rate, you remember in the Carter years and stuff like that.
Which is when? For those that don't know the Carter years.
Starting in the mid-70s, okay, general inflation was going up, and medical inflation, because of all these things that we talked about, the increasing technologies, the drugs started to appear, and they, you know, it was starting to be leveraged, okay. There were lots of factors going on, too. There wasn't a lot of regulation. Underwriting rules and methodologies were being experimented with. You could, you know, there was just all kinds of stuff going on. That was all in the insurance industry. Ed alluded to talking about, you know, the cost, controlling the cost. Well, see, one of the things would help if we could identify what the cost actually was. Okay. Imagine the administrative expenses that we spend today that are part of the waste in the system, then this was being developed back then, okay? That's why I'm talking about it. But today, there's a massive administrative cost. Even though it's not enough to be the cause of everything, it's significant. Why? Because we have 100 different costs for the same physician or the same hospital for the same service, depending on who the payer is. This insurance company A, insurance company B, insurance company C, Medicaid, Medicare, insurance company A, plan B, insurance company B, plan C. It's got all of that stuff. The administrative cost to just track all that stuff at the insurance company level is one thing. At the provider is another. Now, the provider charges a rate, right, which we call claims cost. But guess what's inside that cost? Administrative costs at that provider. The hospital's got, you know, a huge room full of clerks that are sitting there trying to sort out, okay, this person came in, it was this insurance company, it was this plan, we're in that network, this is what we're going to, you know, when the EOB comes back and we have to find the right slot. Imagine the savings that would exist if a given provider had one rate sheet and said, this is what we charge and expect to get from everybody who comes in the door. I don't care who it is. Okay. But
how would an insurance company compete in a market where everything is the same?
Why should we turn over to an insurance company the ability to negotiate a price for me? Who gave them this power in the first place? We created this monster by giving them this power. And now they've created an oligopoly and an oligopsony, an oligarchy. Pick your ollie. Okay. And now it's, we just want money flowing through, right? Because there's no insurance risk anymore. If we get a big enough volume, we're never going to lose any money on the claim, on the true claims. We're making money off the cash flow that comes through.
Spread.
Okay. And I'm a stock company, and all I care about is how my stock performs. How do I get revenue? I increase premiums. Would I increase premiums if I actually were able to lower claims costs because I wouldn't have to charge as much? Well, then my revenue would go down. And then my 5% of the revenue that I get as my net income would go down. And my stock price would drop because everyone would say, well, you got no future.
They're not performing.
They're not performing.
They lost money.
They have no motivation whatsoever to lower this cost. We've given them the ability to go out and cut a deal with the providers, et cetera. But why? Why did we need to do that? If every provider had their own rate sheet, okay, the insurers would compete by deciding how much they would allow to be paid as a covered expense. And then they would go around trying to find those providers who...
With the best outcomes
and be willing to pay their rate or make up the difference, okay? Okay, and then that's how they would compete. They would have to do what the original PPO was, Preferred Provider Organization, because we were going to have the best providers, okay, and we're going to cut a deal with them. Well, you cut the deal by agreeing to what they charge, not making them take what you offer, okay? And in an environment like that, then they will decide, okay, are they worth it? Is this doctor worth paying 10% more than my schedule? Then I can agree to do that, okay, because they're worth it. If they're not worth it, I'm just paying my schedule. And if a person wants to go to that doctor, they'll know ahead of time how much the difference is.
And here's the irony of the current system. If you as a patient needed a procedure, and it could be documented that there are two doctors in this that are really decent, and one is better than the other, but the one that's the better one is not in your network, even though your healthcare result could be better, right? Today, we have educated the population that you need to go to the network doctor because it will cost you less regardless of the health outcome. It's really an absurd system when you think about it.
But how would you're talking about the doctor should do this, the patient should do this. I don't see how a consumer could ever even get involved with negotiating rates. Now, even a doctor.
No, they wouldn't be able to negotiate a rate in the system.
But a doctor, a provider, just like an independent small company, how are they ever going to set their own rates, their own guidelines? I mean,
they do that now.
Practicing medicine.
They do it now. They have a billmaster. It's just that now the billmaster is a meaningless chart, but it doesn't have to be.
You're talking about a doctor's office or facility?
Both.
Talking small doctor's offices.
Oh, they know what they're charging.
What did they do before PPOs?
I don't know. You tell me.
What did the OB-GYN do? He's a businessman, very successful. And what he said was, I'm going to deliver this year 300 babies. All right? Aside from seeing patients in the office, I'll deliver 300 babies and I'm going to do it for $300 a piece. Now, you know, they'd say, well, wait a second, but some of the mothers are higher risk and some of the women are overweight and some of them have a bad history. It didn't make any difference. Doctors did a great job and led a very, they were always upper income, and they were doing it at a fixed price. Now, in fact, if that's what you do, if you deliver babies and you deliver 300, 400, 500, 1,000 of them a year, you probably are pretty good at it compared to the doctor that delivers one every 6 months, right? So should the one that delivers one every 6 months charge more than the doctor who does 1,000 of them a year per delivery? My answer would be no. The best doctor knows how to do things most efficient, and they know what they like to do. So
they cost more because they don't know what they're doing.
Well, maybe.
Or they don't know what to charge.
They don't know what to charge because they don't do it frequently enough. So, I mean, there's all sorts of problems inherent in the system, but I'm going to bring it back to the patient. If we educated the patient that their benefits were in lieu of compensation, with the assumption that if I didn't provide you benefits, I could pay you more, you'd be on your own.
You think that's the key?
No, I don't think that. I think it's too late for that now.
You don't think the consumer, forget about single pay, the consumer, just like using Amazon, we put the power back to them and say, you know what? You go shop it. You pay for these services.
This is where I think technology in the future may be very beneficial. AI, where a patient can say to the computer screen or their cell phone or whatever, you know, I went to my primary care doctor and I have an inguinal hernia and I need to find the best doctor in a 500-mile radius to perform this procedure, and I want to know the cost that those doctors would charge. Now, where the artificial intelligence is going to get that number, I don't know, without a charge master that's realistic, without a doctor saying, I will do this for $300.
Well, there's also some benefit to an integrated medical care system, okay, where there is a benefit to having the doctors who are in a system with surgeons and the hospital facility, and they all share the records and all that sort of thing. But that's all part of technology, too.
Yeah. There's nothing that says that individual practitioners could not have access to a single medical record that was universal throughout this country.
All right.
But again, you've got lobbyists that are saying, wait, there's 200-plus vendors in the medical records business, and they don't talk to each other.
But this is where the advocacy and the administrative service would be there. That's what the administration cost should be spent on, is helping the patients find the right care, understand the price and the cost and all that sort of thing, rather than spending a lot of time trying to avoid paying claims. And, you know, the administrative costs that the TPAs have, administrative costs, it costs money to appropriately adjudicate a claim. What is their job? Their job is to help manage the money of the employer health plan. Okay. And if they're just paying stuff willy-nilly, they're not doing a very good job of that. I mean, there's a contract.
It's more cost effective to do it willy-nilly.
There's a contract that says, this is what we cover, this is how much we pay, this is how we do it, etc. There are always going to be people who don't get stuff that fits into that, you know, that arrangement, and it has to be it's not covered. I'm sorry, but that's not covered. You have a car, okay, that comes with everything except it doesn't have air conditioning, and you went out and needed air conditioning. I'm sorry, we don't cover that, okay? The contract says we don't cover that. Talk to your employer about adding it next year into the benefit plan or something, okay? But the BUCAs, to a large extent, just pay it what comes in the door. They don't care. They really don't. The independent TPA, such as Intrust and its compatriots, okay, do the primary job of adjudication of claims. Not paying claims is easy.
Yeah, break that down, because
claim comes in, you write a check. But were you supposed to pay for that?
And what does that process look like? The adjudication of a claim, and I'm talking about small claims, mid claims, large claims.
Well, it's
versus
not
what the book is doing.
And when can I go live stream again? Because I need to take a break.
But auto adjudication, the carriers are way up in the typically in the 70 to 90 percentile fraud adjudication, which means they have a network, the network contracts a rate, it comes in, they automatically adjudicate the network price. Whether it was medically necessary.
The brother-in-law did it?
Whether the brother-in-law did it, whether, I mean, it's easy to pay claims. In fact, they should simply charge like a transaction charge. Paying claims is a click charge. You know, you should be able to make money writing a check for $5.95 or $4.95 or $6.95 a check. And obviously, then the problem is the more checks you write, the more money you make. So where's the control in that system? But the point is, to adjudicate claims, you have to have, for example, any claim that's over $25,000. Robin can explain this better than I, because she's on the operation and the executive side. There's a large claim committee, which includes the general counsel, it includes a doctor, it includes the nurses, and it includes somebody who truly understands what the provisions of the plan document are. All right. And you have to look at that claim, and sometimes you just question, why are we paying for an assistant surgeon? The surgeon charged $1,200 for the procedure, and there's an assistant in there, and they billed, because they're out of network, $26,000 for being in there with the surgeon?
Well, that's a little, I'm sure there are examples like that, but that's not an average situation.
No, there's some ridiculous examples.
Well, listen, we're going to get into risk management in the next episode, but I think we're going to wrap it there. We talked about the problems. We'll talk about the next steps, the risk management, in a future episode here at the ranch. So with that, guys, thanks so much. Ed Hobson, to be continued, episode 2 coming in the near future when we're back here in Houston. Thanks, guys.